Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Phil Kogan, host of the Amazing Race reality show. But one reality no one chooses as part of their life is multiple sclerosis. Join me and Move It to end MS during MS Awareness Week. Whether you volunteer, bike, walk, advocate, educate, support, every action you take moves us closer to a world free of MS and motivates families, friends, and neighbors to join the MS movement. Progress on MS can't wait. Move it today. Visit nationalmssociety.org.
Good morning and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I'm your host, Joy Keyes. I want to thank you so much for waking up this Saturday morning. Well, it's beautiful today, but it wasn't beautiful a couple days ago here in Philadelphia. It was just rain, 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 and more rain. But today is bright and sunny, and I want to thank you again for joining. Today I have a wonderful guest, Dr. Mary Hughes. She's the Director of Neuroscience Associates. She is the chair at the Neurology Division of Greenville Hospital Systems in Greenville, South Carolina. She won Best Doctor in America Award in 2007 and 2008. She also won the National Multiple Sclerosis Society's Appreciation Plaque for dedication for caring for people living with multiple sclerosis. Thank you so much, Dr. Hughes, for calling in this morning.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
So this is a really debilitating disease, but there's so many different types of multiple sclerosis. I think I want to just talk a little bit about, in general, multiple sclerosis is a chronic, unpredictable disease of the central nervous system, and that includes the brain, the optic nerves, and spinal cord. It is thought to be an autoimmune disorder, and that means that the immune system incorrectly attacks the person's healthy tissue. Tell us about that. What does that mean in, like, lay terms? How can we explain to the audience what that means?
Well, I think you've already touched on some of the real unique features to MS, is that it really is an unpredictable disorder. In MS, the body makes a mistake, and it recognizes a part of itself. And in this case, the conductive coating around the nerves and the brain and the spinal cord as being abnormal. And what it does is when it attacks that, it strips off this conductive coating, and it takes longer for the information to travel from point A to point B. Now, if that nerve is going to your eye, you may not be able to see. If it's going to your leg, you may have weakness in that leg. It's essentially almost as though you're having stroke-like events. Now, the good news is that early on in the disease process, when people have events, they tend to have very good recovery. But over time, the recovery is not as good, and we start to accumulate disability over time. And so that's one of the challenges with MS, is A, it's unpredictable. I can't tell you what the next symptom is going to be, nor can I tell you when it's going to occur. And then realizing that this is a long-term disease and that we're trying to manage not only for today, but to try to slow the progression and disability over time.
I want to read something from Montel Williams' website. Montel Williams is a famous talk show host. When the neurologist said those three words, "you have MS," it hit me like a brick. I thought the diagnosis was a death sentence. I heard of multiple sclerosis, but I didn't really know what it was. I knew it meant excruciating pain and that eventually I could lose control of my body. I also knew there was no cure. That was enough to plunge me in the depths of despair. Now, there are different types of multiple sclerosis, correct? There's a relapsing, remitting, progressive. Someone could be relapsing, remitting, and then become progressive. Talk about that a little bit.
Okay, well, you know, first I'd speak to Montel's quote, and that's one of the challenges, is that his perception of what MS was going to mean may be real for some people, but the good news is the vast majority, excruciating pain is actually relatively rare with MS, and there are very good treatments for that. The early on in the disease case, the disease course is called relapsing remitting. So that, in that history, a patient may say, on Tuesday, I noticed that I'm not seeing as well. The good news is that over the next few weeks to a few months, the body is able to heal itself, and that vision may improve, if not back to baseline, pretty close to it. And then there's a period of time where there are no acute neurologic symptoms, and there may be a time before the next event happens, and that varies from person to person. For one person, it may be weeks. For another one, it may be years to months. Over time, and in the untreated state, over 15 to 20 years, about 50% of people will transition. Instead of being able to say, you know, I was doing well until Tuesday in October when I noticed I was having trouble walking, to the story of, you know, over the last 6 months, I noticed I'm not able to use my hands quite as well. My hand dexterity is not like it used to be, or I'm not able to walk as well as I used to. Mm-hmm. They can't put their finger on a discrete event. And that's the phase in which we really accumulate disability over time.
Now, you said something interesting that in there. I just want to interrupt. You said untreated. So,
right.
I mean, in years past, people did not have treatments that are available to them. Now we have at least four, five, six different types of medicine, Rebif, Avonex, Copaxone. And then I know they have Tysabira, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was very controversial. Say it again.
Tysabri.
Now, that was controversial in the news. I mean, people were dying and all kinds of stuff. Do you want to talk about that medicine and,
mm-hmm.
and what that means for MS and who should be taking it?
Well, I think, you know, the last 10, 20 years have been very exciting in MS. Prior to 1993, there was no FDA treatment for MS that was actually, that could change the course of MS over time. Since then, we do have medications that, and particularly when started early on in the disease process, make it less likely for a person to have an event, make it more likely that event will be milder in the event that it occurs, and slow that progression of time of disability over time. The challenges with what we're seeing is that not only has this been a really exciting time with as we learn more about what is underlying MS from a pathological standpoint, but we're actually being even more aggressive with our treatment. Anytime you become aggressive with a treatment, a conversation of risk versus benefit. The good news is we've had medications that have 15, 20 years of safety data that we can counsel people very comfortably and say that if you're on this medication long term, that you'll be able to tolerate it, that we don't have any unexpected risk. In occasion, depending on the medication, we may need to follow liver functions over time. But those
how,
are things
how do
that
you
can
know,
manage.
How, Dr. Hughes, how do you know which one to take? I mean, how
right.
does the doctor, how do you, the doctor, say, okay, this is the one that's good for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's not much different from, so there are different factors that we take into account when we're choosing a treatment, the presentation. So when we talk about the arms of treatment, if someone comes in right now and they've had an acute event, then the most appropriate treatment for most patients is the steroids. Steroids are the most potent anti-inflammatory that we have. And what
intravenous steroids
is the one we use most commonly, yes.
Okay.
And what that does is it speeds the recovery from the relapse. It doesn't make it any less likely for the next event to happen, and that's where the role of the immune modulating therapies, which until recently have been all given by injection. The injectable medicines we've had for many years now, and we are very comfortable with the fact that they can decrease the severity and frequency of events, but they're not cures. You know, one of the points that I make with my patients is that when you come in with high blood pressure, I can't look at you and tell which high blood pressure medicine you should be on. I don't have a magic crystal ball.
Mm-hmm,
but what I do is I pick one, and maybe there are certain features. Maybe you have some other medical illness or there are some other medications. Maybe you're on another medicine that affects your liver, and so I may not want to choose one of the injectables that may also affect your liver. But I make that first choice, and then we monitor that choice. And one of the things that's important to know is that if you're not responding as well as we'd like you to, that we have other options. And
now, let me
ask
you, how do you know that you have MS? You mentioned earlier about stroke-like symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
there's tingling, there could be pain, there could be paralysis,
right.
it could be shaking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you know, and how do you know it's not lupus? Because that's a very another autoimmune disease.
Right. Well, so part of making the diagnosis of MS is looking for things that help support the diagnosis. So there are typical changes that we may see in the spinal fluid. There are typical MRI findings. But it's also ruling out other diseases that may mimic multiple sclerosis. So, for example, lupus, while it can, in rare occasions, affect the brain, it's much more likely to affect the joints. So it's more of an arthritis. It actually affects the organs more often.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lab tests that we very routinely do when we're working somebody up for a possible diagnosis of MS to look to see if there's evidence that may support an alternative diagnosis like lupus.
Okay. Now, some people have MS and nobody in her entire family has MS, and some people have three or four people. Are there studies out there that say, you know, you're more susceptible if your grandmother has it or your aunt has it? Where does that come in?
Well, you know, the genetics of MS is getting an enormous amount of interest. In the general population, the risk of MS is about 1% to 2%. If you have a family member, a first-degree family member, a sister, a parent that has MS, your risk doubles and goes to 2% to 4%. Now, the other side of the coin is if you have MS, 15% of people with MS have another family member that has MS. It's actually relatively rare to have families that have more than one person affected, and there's enormous interest in those families to see if there's a particular genetic factor that's made it more likely in those families. So while, generally speaking, it does not run in families, there are rare, relatively rare occasions when it can, and that's one of the areas of research that in the last few years has just really been a lot of interest played, but also a lot of really intriguing work coming out of that. Because if we can look at not only the genetic factors that predict who's going to get MS, but potentially the genetic factors that may predict how you respond to a specific treatment, maybe that can help me make the decision of what initial treatment you need to be on.
Yeah.
And there are examples in other diseases where we use that information.
Now, mostly women are affected, but men also are affected by MS. What is the percentage of women versus men? Do you know?
So in the most common form of MS, relapsing remitting, women are affected 3 to 4 times more often than men. There is another subset of MS called primary progressive, and that disease, men and women are equally affected.
Now, a lot of people with MS, and I guess with the most chronic diseases, but particularly I've read with MS, suffer from depression.
Yes,
how do you, when the patient comes in, I mean, people always talk about your mental state really affects your health, affects so many things in your life. How do you help a patient deal with that depression or the despair of, oh, no, I have MS, or just, you know, I'm in a lot of pain or discomfort or I can't do what I need to do in my life? How do you help them with that, either sending them to a therapist or through medicines, antidepressants?
Well, I think certainly one of the challenges, depression in the general population, one of the challenges is 80% of all women will have at least one episode of major depression in their lifetime. Depression is common. The challenge with that is it's also under-recognized, under-diagnosed. With MS, we certainly have a heightened awareness for that, and whether that's a reactive depression, you've gotten a new diagnosis, and how do you deal with that? You certainly heard that in Montel's quote that you read earlier, of what the impact that had getting the new diagnosis. How do we help with people? Part of that is the uncertainty. What does the future hold for me? What is MS? What are my choices? What are my options? What can I expect long term? The role of patient education and really educating the person living with MS so that they have appropriate expectations, they know what are real potential realities, what are myths of MS.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other is
people aren't going to die from MS. Is that correct? People are not going to die.
The life expectancy for people for MS is essentially normal. No. So it's not
a life-threatening
disease.
Yeah. And it's not contagious. It's not like something I can touch or feel and I'm going to give it to you or pass it along.
No, it's not contagious.
To someone else.
No, it's true.
Let's talk a bit about the treatments, the oral medications. I may not be pronouncing these correctly, but fingolimod and cladribine.
That's we all struggle with these. I always say you shouldn't go into a field you can't say the names, but we'll just pretend like we say. And so there have been two pills in front of the FDA, and of course, in a disease where the treatments have been predominantly by injection, there's a lot of interest in when are we going to get a pill. Fingolimod, and we don't know what the sexy trade name is going to be when it comes to the market, is still in front of the FDA. It actually is a very different approach to how we treat MS. One of the things that, as we start to understand what parts of the immune system are involved with MS, we certainly are being impressed with how extensive and how many different parts of the immune system are involved. And so this is a novel way of teaching or treating it. It happens to be by pill. Cladribine actually, unfortunately, has been sent back to the company for further investigation. So that's
from
the FDA
Merck Serona. That's from Merck Serona.
Right. So
they've
taken that back to look. And I think that one of the lessons we've learned is that while we want to be very aggressive with the treatment of MS, we also want to make sure that we are not increasing risk way out of proportion to what would be acceptable. So in a disease that is not life-threatening, the risk-benefit ratio is very different from, for example, a cancer that is life-threatening.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned that with the Tysabri, which came on the market a little over, I guess, just about 5-7 years ago. What we didn't anticipate is that it increased the risk for having a brain infection called PML. We didn't know about that risk. We weren't aware that we were affecting the immune system in such a dramatic way. Although the risk is somewhere around 1 in 1,000, obviously if you're that 1, that's 100% risk. But we need to be able to balance the risks versus the potential benefits of the medications. And I think that's one of the messages I think is very important, is that while, of course, we want a pill, we also want safe and effective medications for multiple sclerosis.
Yeah, you don't want to, bring on other symptoms, I guess, a digestive system and things of that nature. Now, I talked to you briefly about an article I read in the New York Times. This is just a couple days ago, March 22nd. And this is dealing with bad veins in MS patients versus healthy patients. And people were going overseas to get their brain drained of blood. And this is by a doctor, a certified doctor. How do you talk to your patients when they come to you and they're suffering? How do you counsel them to say, maybe you should wait or maybe you should go?
Right. Well, I think that really comes into role of making sure that we partner and that we make sure our patients is well educated about what MS is. You know, the problem with that whole theory is that we know a lot about MS, but we've certainly never, there's no real good data that really supports that by revascularizing the brain, by changing the way the blood flows in the brain, that is actually going to affect MS. Now, when one physician has a very effective study, then we're very encouraged by that. But I think one of the things we also know is that we want to see that replicated. Unfortunately, many examples, right, we want to see that not only that physician can get those results, that other physicians can get that result. And we also want to make sure that we do what we call very controlled studies, that we can really give good information about the safety related to it. So there is actually projects underway in the United States to look at that in a study form where people can get very close monitoring, where we can get very good information and really have a good sense of whether or not that is a potential treatment for multiple sclerosis. You know, in many ways, it sort of came out of left field, and I'm always cautious when things come out of left field. I'm always cautious, and I think that's what I always really want to, I certainly spend a lot of time talking to my patients, is here's what we understand, here's what the theory is behind that. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, in MS, many things have been advocated for cure. When you have a disease that is not, we don't have a cure for, many treatments have been proposed, and we want to be able to just make really good, informed decisions about what the risk versus the benefit and what's the science that really supports this intervention.
Yes. Now, when people come in and have MS, children can have MS, adults can have MS, we talk men and women can have MS, what do you tell their family? What do you tell their spouses? How can they support a person who has MS?
Well, and I think you hit on something that's very, very important, is when a family member gets diagnosed with MS, the family has MS. How do you adapt for that? So if it's a parent, one of the symptoms with MS that can be very prominent is difficulty with heat sensitivity. And so something is every day as taking your child to Disney World, but you may not want to take your child to Disney World in July when it's 100 degrees outside. How do you pace yourself? One of the things that we really work with people is to try to minimize the effect that MS has on their day-to-day life. But it's also educating your family to say what are appropriate expectations. It's not that mom doesn't want to come to your baseball game when it's 103 degrees. It's that mom may not be able to tolerate the heat. Now, we may be able to approach that with helping her with cooling, everything from cooling vests, to advising to drink ice water while she's out there so she can tolerate it better. Mm-hmm. To mom's not there for the mid-afternoon game, but boy, is she there for the early Saturday morning game.
Now, does everyone with MS affected by the heat, or what about the cold? What about the winter?
Well, in MS, nothing's 100%. So I would say that it's much more common to be affected by heat. In fact, one of the oldest tests for MS was called the hot bathtub test. We know that heat slows the transmission of information to the nerve. So when you heat a nerve that already has challenges with conducting information, it makes those symptoms more prominent. So that's one of the ways that used to diagnose MS way in the past. The reality is that it's one of the challenges many people who are living with MS have to face, is how do they manage the heat? But there are a good number of people who also note that they are cold sensitive. And so we need to be able, it's an individual disease, we need to meet that person with what their challenges are and to help them cope with that in their daily life.
As best we can, yeah. So I guess a family member really just is the flexibility of the situation. Now, what about physical therapy? If somebody has an exacerbation where the symptoms flare up, how can physical therapy help them maybe overcome or just go back to some close to baseline activity?
Right. Well, I think, you know, the role of therapy is always if there's weakness, to try to help with weakness. But sometimes the role of therapy is also saying, if we can't do it the way we used to do it, is there another way we can do it? So if the goal is to get you from point A to point B, is there an alternative? Is it an assistive device that we may need to use, like a cane, to get you there? Is it a different way of learning how to put your socks on so that you not only save the energy, so you don't spend as much energy to do that, so you can use that energy someplace else in a much more pleasurable place? And that really, you know, gets to the wellness issues for people living with MS, which are the same as the wellness issues that you and I have. That we need to be exercising, we need to be eating healthy diets, and that becomes even more important. The better you take care of the machine, the better the machine is able to, the machine being the body in this example, the better the body is able to withstand and to tolerate a disease like multiple sclerosis.
Now, what about people's diet and eating? Are there things they shouldn't eat? Some people, I read about dairy products, some people become vegans. What is your, from your perspective as a doctor, are there certain things people should or shouldn't eat, and do they trigger an exacerbation in a person with MS?
There's no literature support, no good scientific literature support that there's any particular food that will trigger an exacerbation or worsen the disease course. That said, people have different sensitivities, and that certainly is something that when it's incorporated in a healthy diet, and I think that's really the emphasis, is to make sure that you're getting a good, healthy diet. There are a number of diets that have been proposed for MS, and when you look really closely, and one of the most famous ones is the Swank diet. I'll point out that Dr. Swank lived to almost 90, so, you know, if he followed his own, he must have been doing something right. But when you look at his diet, it was a very low fat. It minimized sugars. I kind of laugh sometimes to say, if it tastes good, spit it out, because you may be doing something wrong. But it's a very strict diet. But that is when you look at diets for good cardiac health. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, you know, when you look at really the fine point of what he said his benefits for his diet were, he mentions that needs to be done in conjunction with exercise and healthy living.
Yeah.
And so it really is the same rule that you and I have. Unfortunately, there's no magic food or lack of that's going to change the disease course itself.
What about homeopathic or herbs and things of that nature?
Mm-hmm.
People, you know, massage is another thing that people say help relieve their pain or give them a little more mobility. Mm-hmm. Acupuncture, what do you think about these other alternative medicines?
Well, I actually prefer the term complementary. Because we have medications that we use that are FDA approved for multiple sclerosis. And if you're appropriate for those medications, we strongly encourage that you should be on them. What can we do to complement that? And there are a wide range of things. And I think part of it goes back to what is our understanding of MS. You know, some of the treatments, so if I use one of the ones that are around for a long time, has actually been bee sting therapy or bee venom.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the fine point for the fine print of why is bee sting or bee venom proposed as a treatment for MS, it states it's going to help you boost your immune system. But the challenge is
you don't
want to
do that, right? Because
don't understand that the problem with your immune system is not that it's underactive, but that in one particular area it's overactive, and do we really want to be boosting that any further? So I certainly encourage people living with MS to discuss the things that they're considering with their physician. Massage, acupuncture, all of those can be very complementary. Certainly have found use in, as you said, gait and pain control, spasticity, all of those things have really, you know, those interventions have been found to be very helpful and can be incorporated into, you know, a total treatment plan for living with MS.
Now, fatigue is another big symptom that can just kind of wipe people out. I've read stories of people going on vacation and hoping to have a good time, and then they just slept the whole time on their vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I'd like you to speak to is the cognitive issues of memory loss with MS.
Mm-hmm.
So fatigue and memory loss, how can people deal with that issue in their life with medicine or with the complementary therapies?
And so, you know, you touched on two of the symptoms that are most common. Fatigue, you know, one of the challenges when people say fatigue-related MS, we kind of look around and go, well, I'm tired too. I mean, I don't know too many people who don't say, you know, I'm tired. But the fatigue related to MS is somewhat unique. Some of the more creative descriptions, a woman said it felt as though she was walking underwater with a fur coat on, an enormous dragging sensation. It can be a physical fatigue. It can also be a mental fatigue. You know, everything from pacing yourself to using medications that may help with energy. We want to certainly make sure there's nothing contributing to that may be contributing to the fatigue. So making sure, for example, that we've not missed that there's a thyroid disorder that may be contributing to low energy, that people are sleeping well at night, so that we do everything we can to manage the symptoms around that may be contributing to that. You mentioned cognition. 70% of people with MS will have problems with cognition. Now, I always tell them they're not going to forget the name of their spouse unless they just want to. It's not that kind of problem.
Yeah, but you said 70%. So,
70%.
Yeah,
but it's problems with attention, concentration, easy distractibility. It's kind of word finding. You, the tip of the tongue, you know, I just can't quite get that word out. Recognition and being aware of it, particularly in families, communicating that so people understand that. We certainly, if people are in the work environment, try to minimize distractions. For example, you know, if you can work in an area that is that perhaps you can close your door so that you're, when you're doing
not
a task,
distracted.
People aren't constantly interrupting you. If you're doing paying the bills, turn the TV off so that you don't have more than one thing going on, which is probably, you know, good advice for all the rest of us, too. But
yeah,
in that,
one
yeah,
day at a
never,
time.
Right, exactly. We certainly spend a lot of time multitasking. And I don't know that any of us are very effective with as effective as we could be. But with MS, we spend a lot more time talking about strategic things that we can do to really try to maximize them.
Now, we only have a couple minutes left. What are some things that you would tell a newly diagnosed person with MS? If they find out they have MS, what would you tell them in like two sentences or so?
You have MS. You're not going anywhere. What we're going to be doing, working together, is to minimize the impact that it has on your life, that the better educated you are about MS, the better you can partner with your healthcare provider, and the better educated a patient, the better a patient does, that not only do we have treatments that we didn't have in the past, that there is an enormous pipeline of new research that is going to have even more impact on the disease process over time. And if anything, this is the time of just enormous hope for people living with MS. And this is something that is manageable and that you too can live a good life, a good quality of life with multiple sclerosis.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Mary Hughes. This is your Director of Neuroscience Associates. She's the Chair at the Neurology Division of Greenville Hospital Systems in Greenville, South Carolina. Thank you so much, Dr. Hughes. I think you really educated the audience this morning about what is multiple sclerosis and how to manage it. I want to let the people know that Dr. Hughes is here. I want to thank the National Multiple Sclerosis Society and Arnie Rosenblatt for getting her on today. You can check out nationalmssociety.org. There's so many other organizations that are out there. They have links to them. They have resources in your area, local chapters you can visit to help you with legal issues, work issues, health issues, finding exercise, all types of things the National Multiple Sclerosis Society can help you with. Thank you so much, Dr. Hughes, for coming on this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I want to thank all the listeners out there for listening in this morning. And if you have time, you can stay tuned. I'm doing another show, 11:30 to 12, with filmmaker Lindsay Christian. She recently did a film called Jazz in the Diamond District featuring Wood Harris. You might recognize him from The Wire, Southland Tales, Remembering the Titans. Also, Clifton Powell was in the movie Ray, Friday, Norbit. So Jazz in the Diamond District, tune in 11:30 to 12 today. And next week we're going to be talking about autism. So please tune in for that. April is Autism Awareness Month. Later in the month we'll be talking about alcohol addiction. So I hope that you can join in both of those shows. Become a fan on Facebook, and you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/joykeys. Again, you can become a fan on Facebook or follow me on twitter.com/joykeys. I hope to see you in the next half an hour, if not next week, 11 a.m. Eastern, here on Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Phil Cogan, host of the Amazing Race reality show. But one reality no one chooses as part of their life is multiple sclerosis. Join me and move it to end MS during MS Awareness Week. Whether you volunteer, bike, walk, advocate, educate, support, every action you take moves us closer to a world free of MS and motivates families, friends, and neighbors to join the MS movement. Progress on MS can't wait. Move it today. Visit nationalmssociety.org.